So this is joint work with Giovanni Vigna at UC Santa Barbara. And so, yes, web applications. We've all used them. They're very popular, of course, and this is for good reason. They're very easy to develop, of course. They are easy to deploy and correspondingly easy to update due to the centralized model. And finally, they are also accessible from anywhere. Just about anyone with a relatively modern browser and an internet connection can execute one of these apps. Unfortunately, they are also completely broken in many cases. A great motivating example here is this recent report released about web applications exposed by the US Federal Aviation Administration. And this report found that over 70 web applications, there were a huge number of vulnerabilities discovered, ones that might allow attackers to gain unauthorized access to information or gain unauthorized access to air traffic control systems, inject malicious code on FAA systems. This is always a very comforting thought when I fly these days. And so these vulnerabilities really have quite a bit of severity or potential severity. In addition, it's a pervasive problem. And so I pulled this graph from the latest Symantec Internet Global Threat Report, and it shows that in 2007 and 2008, web vulnerabilities were the most, or comprised the majority of all reported vulnerabilities, according to Symantec, hovering somewhere around 60%. And of these vulnerabilities, the majority still are some variant of cross-site scripting and SQL injection. And so we all know what this is. I won't belabor this too much, but cross-site scripting involves an attack where you have some malicious input to a web application that is reflected back to the user that performs some kind of malicious transformation of the page. And so in this case, in this example, we have a hypothetical templating language where the developer intends to substitute user input in the value attribute of a hidden form field. And so the expected behavior is something like this. Of course, an attacker could do something like that and pull down some malicious JavaScript from a server they control. And at that point, any number of things could happen. For instance, the script could attempt to exploit some browser vulnerabilities and join the thing into a botnet, for instance. SQL injection has kind of the same flavor. So you have some structure that's specified by the developer. In this case, we want to reset the password of a user account. And so you might expect to see something like this, but unfortunately, an attacker could insert a value that would modify the structure of the query in order to reset the administrator password. Okay, so there's a ton of these vulnerabilities, and they can be quite severe in their consequences. And so, of course, there's been a huge amount of work that's gone into looking at how to prevent these or detect if they've been introduced into an application. So one example is some kind of intrusion detection using either misuse or anomaly-based techniques in order to identify and perhaps prevent these vulnerabilities from being exploited, although the web application may still contain these vulnerabilities, and this is kind of a stopgap measure, but something that works fairly well in practice. There are a number of automated static and dynamic analyses that can be performed to detect whether these vulnerabilities have been introduced into a program and to prevent them at runtime. And there are also, of course, penetration testing and manual code auditing techniques that can be used. And these are all great. There's advantages and disadvantages to each approach, and the sad thing is that we still have these vulnerabilities, and they're still being exploited. And so let's take a step back and see why this is. Well, our observation is that these web documents, HTML documents, and database queries are oftentimes treated by applications simply as unstructured sequences of bytes. And this provides a lot of flexibility, but on the other hand, at the level of the language or framework, there's no knowledge of what portions of these strings actually comprise the structure and which portions comprise the content. And so, as a result, the developer is, it's on the part of the developer to actually manually insert checks to sanitize content. And as an analogy, this is similar to the state of programming before we had nice exploit mitigation systems like Stack Canaries, where the programmer had to ensure that all user input was checked so that the stack couldn't be smashed. Unfortunately, as we saw, you know, even the most talented developer is only human, and humans are fallible. And unfortunately, it only takes one successful exploit to completely compromise the security of your application. And so this is not really what we want. What we want is some kind of automated way to prevent the integrity of these objects from being corrupted by an attacker. And so we looked at a language-based system to address this. In particular, we looked at leveraging existing work on language safety, namely the type system. And in our work, we explicitly denote the structure and the content of web documents and database queries. And because the language or the framework is now aware of what the intended structure of these objects is, it can then be held responsible for actually preserving their integrity. And the goal here is to lift as much burden as possible from the developer. And in particular, we're aiming for no testing, no separate analyses that need to be run, and no specification of policies on the part of the developer. In short, our philosophy is that if the web application compiles, i.e. it passes the type checker, then we consider the application to be safe against a large class of vulnerabilities. Okay, so we implemented a prototype framework using Haskell. And applications in this framework are implemented simply as a set of functions that perform computations within the special environment that we construct called the app monad. And there's a lot of hype surrounding monads. For the purposes of this talk, you can consider it to be a kind of sandbox within which the application executes. And so at runtime, requests are routed based on their path to one of these functions, and the function takes that as input, performs some computation, and returns a document. And so that's the high-level overview. So let's jump in and see what one of these documents looks like. So in our system, the document is not manipulated or represented as a stream of bytes. Instead, we look at it as a tree of nodes, okay? So you can see on this slide, it looks very similar to the abstract representation of an HTML page. So you have a document, you have a document head, which has a title node, link node, maybe some script references. Then you have a document body, which actually specifies the structure of the page that's presented to the user. When we look at how these are actually defined, you can see there's simply a node type constructor that takes a set of data constructors. So we have one for text nodes, which have a field that holds the text that is to be displayed to the user, which could be arbitrary. Anchor nodes, which have some standard attributes like ID, class, et cetera, link references, and subnodes, and div nodes, et cetera. So the key point here is that in our system, applications never deal with raw text. And so this is enforced directly by this type system, which you can see in the second bullet, we have a type signature for one of these document generation functions. And it takes only as input the HTTP request and returns a document tree, as we saw in the previous slide, created within the sandbox. And so the application only deals with documents. And it's the framework's responsibility to actually render this document into the stream of bytes that will be delivered to the user. So graphically, we have our document as before. On the left is a domain of the web app. It's passed to the framework, and only in the framework is it serialized. OK, as part of the serialization, Well, in order to implement the serialization, every type that comprises the document must implement this render type class. And this is simply an interface where we have one function called render that takes an arbitrary type and converts it into a string. And so the implicit contract of this function is that when it is converting whatever type it takes to a string, it'll also perform sanitization on that type. And so this is context specific, so the type of sanitization that is performed within an attribute value might be different from that performed within a URL, but the takeaway is that this is all automatically done by the framework. Okay, so let's look at database queries. Here the situation is slightly different. So database queries, there already exists a quite nice mechanism to fix the structure of queries that are issued, and this is exactly prepared statements. So our twist on this is that, similar to the case of, say, you're hardening libc and you want to remove unsafe functions like string copy, inside this application monad, we restrict the type of database calls that may be made to only those safe functions that manipulate prepared statements. And so if we look at this graphically, you can see that our application resides in the center here, and it's surrounded by several layers of monads that comprise the app monad, app config, app state, and app IO. Surrounding the entire thing is the IO monad, and it's within the IO context that arbitrary computations can be performed, computations that might produce side effects, et cetera, and it is here where the database functions live. The trick is we use some typed system machinery in order to hide certain data constructors such that only those functions that we want to execute that we consider safe inside the application are imported. And this includes only the prepared statements, for instance, in the case of database functions. Okay, so this takes care of a large class of queries, but of course, we have a small problem. Not all queries are static in structure, and so one clear example of this is the set membership operator in SQL. Here we have a statement where we want to select all users where the login is in some set. Here it's a singleton admin. Of course, if we want to check more than one, so admin or devel, for instance, we have a problem because as we add more elements, the structure of the query actually changes. And so this can't be represented as a prepared statement. So to address this, we define an alternate interface to the database. And here we give to the application the option of using a set of function combinators. And these combinators implement an embedded domain-specific language. And this language allows the application to construct at runtime arbitrary queries as a set of nodes in a tree, similar to the case of documents. And so by doing this, we allow more complex and dynamically structured queries to be constructed. And then when they are to be executed, they're passed to the framework. And within the framework, a similar process of rendering is applied to actually serialize the tree into a raw SQL query. OK. So in order to kind of improve our confidence or validate our intuition that this should work, we performed an evaluation of the sanitization functions. First, we performed a control flow analysis of the framework to evaluate their coverage. And secondly, we looked at the correctness of each individual function. So it's a little difficult to see, but on this slide is the major component level control flow graph for the framework. And the majority of it is all contained within the framework itself, within the trusted core, and is dealing mainly with network sends and receives, dealing with forking off processes to handle threads, et cetera, to handle separate clients. And there's only one path near the bottom, OK. Well, there's only one path where documents are actually allowed to return into the framework. And so what the takeaway here is that there's only one path where the application can return documents into the framework, and it is only as a document tree and never as a raw string. And so the sanitization functions are always applied to every piece of data that is returned to the user. In order to evaluate the correctness of these sanitization functions, we took a test-driven approach. And in particular, our goal was to check that certain invariants hold over the entire domain of inputs to these sanitization functions. Specifically, we want these invariants to be such that the output of these sanitization functions never contain certain unescaped characters, depending on the context. And so we used a quick check library, the quick check library, which is a very nice property testing tool to generate a million random test cases to feed as input to these rendering functions. And in all cases, they passed. That is, the invariants held, and we never accidentally passed through unescaped dangerous character. We also took a number of examples from the JavaScript or cross-site scripting and SQL injection cheat sheets and tested that the invariants failed over unsanitized examples from those. And that also worked. Okay. And if we look at one of our invariants, you can see that it's quite simple. For instance, if we want to check that the attribute value rendering function works correctly, we simply look at the output and of the rendering function and ascertain whether there is ever any unescaped left-right brackets, double quotes, or ampersands after entities have been stripped, as an example. We also evaluated the performance of our framework against two other widely used frameworks. First, the Apache Tomcat framework, and Pylons, which is a Python version of Ruby on Rails, essentially, and it's used to power several high-profile sites. With these three frameworks, we implemented a shopping cart-based web application and evaluated both the throughput and latency of this application under the three frameworks. So first, for the latency plot, latency here is plotted against as a function of concurrent clients. And we can see that the Tomcat framework performs the best. It's the lowest curve among the three. The Pylons framework actually performed the worst. So it's the top curve that goes up into the upper right corner. And we split the difference in this case. There's a similar story with the throughput plot. And so here, towards the top is clearly better. And Tomcat, again, performs the best. And Pylon is the lowest curve, while we are somewhere in the middle. And so on the one hand, these results are encouraging, because with this unoptimized prototype, we were able to perform competitively with existing frameworks. On the other hand, since we are compiling to native code, it was a little disappointing to see that we weren't at least a little bit closer to Tomcat, and so we did some profiling of our application, and we found that because of our use of Haskell strings, which are represented as sequences of characters, the string operations were quite expensive, and so there are some simple optimizations that could be done in order to improve the performance of the system by simply switching to a different string package. And so, in total, given the security benefits that come with using our framework, as well as the quite reasonable performance, given that it's unoptimized in its current state, we're quite pleased with these results. Okay, so I will conclude. We observed that cross-site scripting and SQL injections stem directly from a failure to enforce the integrity of documents and database queries. But the type system is powerful enough to allow a framework to automatically prevent the introduction of server-side vulnerabilities we showed that our prototype framework is quite effective at preventing exploitation. And finally, that reasonable latency and throughput is achieved by our unoptimized prototype. And so at this point, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Adam.
I was wondering if you had any thoughts on how your scheme could extend to cross-site scripting vulnerabilities on the client side, so in JavaScript,
yes.
And how it compares to like Google Web Toolkit and other sort of things that build the DOM and memory on the server.
So that's something that we're currently investigating. So we don't provide protection against client-side cross-site scripting, as an example, but that's something that we're investigating. And yeah, I think one reasonable approach would be to try to extend the type safety benefits of the system to the client by compiling, for instance, a representation of the client-side code at the server into JavaScript that would be executed on the client, similar to how Google Web Toolkit works. So I think that would be a promising approach.
Thank you.
I had a question about testing your sanitizers.
Sure.
Have you considered using symbolic execution to get better assurance instead of random testing?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Have you considered using symbolic execution to test your sanitizers?
No, actually I haven't. So that would be a promising avenue to improve the testing. I agree that random is probably not the best that one could do. But with a high number of test cases, you know, there is some level of assurance there. Another option, I think would be to actually test also against the browsers themselves, because there are quirks of the different rendering engines that might, that might not be expected, really. And so to have a ground truth against the actual execution of documents on the browsers themselves would, I think, be best.
Right. So there is work in ICSI this year that's actually quite relevant to that.
Thank you.
Are there further questions? I'll ask one if no one else has any others. One aspect of this work that I really admired was the way that you use a type system to make it impossible for a programmer to even express SQL injection or cross-site scripting bugs. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about other classes of vulnerabilities where one might try to do something like that. Do you see any promising directions for future work on this type of approach?
That's a good question. So the attractiveness of using the type system for this is that SQL injections and cross-site scripting vulnerabilities really are quite simple, and they can be easily expressed or easily prevented using a system like this. I think in the cases of vulnerabilities where there are, you know, where they're more complex, it may be more difficult, and it's something that we're considering, but it's not something that I have any concrete thoughts on at the moment.
All right, let's thank our speaker. Thank you.